Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is Francis Schott, and I am here with Mark Pascal. We are the Restaurant Guys. We run Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can call us at 732-545-9282, or you can visit us at restaurantguysradio.com.
Today we're going to talk about cheese, some of the great things that you can do with cheese as far as serving it by itself or with great wine. We're also going to talk a little bit to a friend of ours in Austria, a gentleman by the name of Peter Schleimer.
Schleimer.
Who is a very good friend of Francis's, and they have been known to ne'er do well together.
To neither do well?
Correct.
I like the German language. Like Schleimer. It's very, like, dramatic language. Anyway, I don't know how I got off on that, but we're going to talk.
I usually
about,
don't know how you. Get
we're
going to
talk about cheese, cheese, which is a fascinating topic, and that's what we're going to start with. And later in the hour, we'll come out to my friend Peter Schleimer, who is an Austrian wine writer, food critic, restaurant critic, exporter to the United States, and a really interesting guy.
A really interesting guy.
But first, we're going to talk about cheese. And Mark, you're the cheesiest guy I know. So that was
someone help me get me out of the booth.
Sometimes you go for the low hanging fruit. You know, it's right there.
God.
Anyway. So, but you're the cheesiest guy I know. Why don't you talk a little bit about how what our relationship at Stage Left, which has now sort of grown up into being one of the most well-regarded restaurants in the state, thank heaven, thank you critics, thank you public, thank you everyone. But we started with rather humble origins with cheese.
Yeah, as a kid for me, my dad was born in France and came here when I was about 9 or 10 years old. And I'm sorry, when he was about 9 or 10 years old, and just was this crazy maniacal cheesehead. Whenever we went anywhere,
I think the same of you.
Whenever we went anywhere, didn't matter. And we lived up in Montreal for a short time when I was very young. So any trip, pretty much between New Jersey and Montreal, any random cheese shop that happened in our way, we were forced to stop at as a kid, and we were forced to go in and sample all the cheeses. And my father was one of those the stinkier the better kinds of guys.
My father, I am. Mark is half French and half Italian, and I am. Well, Irish with a little bit of German there. So
Francis didn't have any good food when he was a kid.
I had some. My mother's listening, Mark. But I didn't have a lot. I didn't have the same rich culinary background.
She knows she boiled your food.
For a long time, too. So my cheese heritage is more of the Velveeta strain of cheese. But I discovered it late in life, and it's been one of the great passions that I've come across. And Mark and I own a restaurant, as unlikely as that is. We went to college together. And now we own one of the best restaurants in Jersey. And one of the things where we were a pioneer was introducing a cheese course to the restaurant, which actually is a very expensive thing to do from a restaurant. And restaurants, honestly, you may not believe this because we have a reputation of being an expensive place, and we are, but you don't make money on cheese because cheese is a very sort of expensive and difficult thing to handle and handle well. But we felt it was important because where we dined in Europe,
every great restaurant, I'm sorry, almost every restaurant in Europe has a cheese course.
And the great restaurants, definitely.
And the great restaurants, definitely. And now in the United States, every great restaurant has a great cheese
course. And we're happy to report that we no longer have to drive into New York every 2 weeks and go pick up our cheese ourselves and struggle and fight to sneak cheeses in. We actually have a maitre de fromage in the restaurant. We have a cheese program. And there are several other great restaurants that have great cheese programs. Nicholas, Restaurant Nicholas in
Absolutely.
Middletown has
Nicholas
a great cheese program.
Stagehouse Inn in Scotch
Plains. Stagehouse Inn in Scotch Plains.
That's a great cheese course.
And to discuss cheese with us, we have on the line our own maitre de fromage, which is just a pretentious French way of saying the cheese master, but cheese master just doesn't sound right. No one wants to buy from the cheese master. We have John Kafarski on the phone.
People buy from the cheese bowl all the time.
That's you. Back at the restaurant, we have John Kafarski. John, are you with us?
Good morning, guys.
How you doing, John?
Doing just fine. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great. We want to talk about cheese, man, and I want to give you a little introduction. Mark and I had this cheese program going, and John sort of asked us several years ago if he could take the cheese ball and run with it, and it's just so easy.
You are the cheese man, cuckoo-ca-choo.
I am the cheese guy.
All right, stop. So John took that ball, and actually, he's one of our employees, made us very proud because he came back and learned a lot more about cheese and did a lot of digging, and now we age cheeses ourselves and our own cows in the restaurant, and John's in charge of all of this. It's been a wild ride you've taken us on, John.
Well, absolutely. It started started a couple of years ago when I asked the sous chef at the time if I could work on the cheese program, and he said, yeah, sure. You know?
Actually, we had a very angry chef at the time who said, no, of course you can't. But then we fired him, and then the next chef let John do that.
Yeah, and it was great. You know, I started studying the cheeses, and I started reading about it just like anything else in a restaurant. You know, you read about the wine, you read about the service. I started reading up on it, and I met some people. And I've just taken it from there, and instead of just ordering cheese and putting it on our board, I actually get great cheeses from around the world, and I put them in our cave downstairs, and I age them myself with the help of you and Mark and the chef, and it's turned into a real treat.
I've always much preferred tasting the cheese than reading about it, though.
Oh, absolutely.
That's one of the reasons I'm so excited that you're doing the the reading and I get to do the tasting.
I will tell you, I though there are a lot of wine-knowledgeable people at Stage Left, and John is actually also a sommelier on the floor, and Mark certainly knows a lot about wine, but I'm sort of in charge of the wine program there, and we're sort of known for the wine program. And, you know, we age things and we take things off the wine list and put them down in the cellar for a period of time. But aging wine and aging cheese are very different. And it's almost, I must say, John, it's almost a little bit of a, like a fetish thing with aging cheese. Because, see, I don't go in and, like, look at my wines every day and check on them and poke them a little bit.
Prod them and make sure that they're just the right softness.
But this is exactly what this man does for a living, and you can see why we hired someone else to do it. But John does love it. When we come back, we'll come back in a second segment, and I want you to talk about aging cheese and what you look for and how that happens. But how did you come to find these cheeses and source these cheeses and taste them? I mean, did you go to New York a lot? How did you turn that book knowledge into, you know, the cheese on the plate?
Well, just like wine and anything else, you really have to do is taste to really learn anything.
John, by the way, is 396 pounds. No, he's not.
Right. Luckily, you know, I went to different restaurants in New York, and then I went to different purveyors in New York as well, and they're happy to give you samples, and they're happy to sit you down for tastings. And also, just, you know, in restaurants around the world, I mean, you go out and you see a cheese board and you taste it, and you get a frame of reference and you get a viewpoint of different cheeses, and then after a while, you start building in your memory banks, and then your palate widens. And
where's the favorite place you've ever visited where you had the best breasts of cheese? Is it somewhere internationally? What city?
Well, I think the best cheeses I had internationally was at a restaurant I was just at in Paris called Guy Savoy,
uh-huh.
Where they actually had a lot of the same exact cheeses that I have on the board here.
That's a nice little compliment there, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was pretty nice. And I must say, ours were just as good. But cheese always tastes better in Paris,
yeah.
Actually.
Everything tastes better in Paris,
especially the Parisians.
That's horrible. Did you just say that?
Is this daytime
radio?
Can
we edit that out? The Guy Savoy, for those of you who don't know, is one of the top-rated restaurants in France, one of the top-rated restaurants in the world. And that's right, it's just like Stage Left. That's what John just said. There's a shameless promotion for you. But when we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about cheese and aging cheese and sourcing cheese. Central Jersey 1450 time is 11:15. Welcome back. We are the Restaurant Guys on 1450 WCTC, and we are here talking with John Kafarsky, who is the maitre de fromage, which is a fancy French way of saying the cheese master at Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick. And we were talking about Paris, where John was just at one of the best restaurants in the world and had a cheese course. But in your experience in Paris, John, I know you've been there a number of times. Is cheese sort of confined to the fancy restaurant?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, of course, at the great restaurants like here, you have the cheeses, but in every bistro, you have your basic cheese, and also it's part of the meal of everyday Parisian life. If you go down to the market where I stayed this past time off Boulevard Saint-Germain, there was, you know, you had your wine shop, you have your butcher, you know, you have your pharmacy, but there's also this beautiful cheese shop. And it wasn't a boutique cheese shop that all Parisians go to, but there's one on every corner.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a staple of their diet. Yeah, it's part of the meal.
And the people there are very knowledgeable too, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I walked in, and, you know, here you have to hire someone to teach a restaurant and its patrons about cheese. But there, you know, every single person knows what they're ordering. They don't need to ask the guy, the fromager, if what cheese is good or what is this and what is that. They know what to get, and it's just a part of their life. I mean, yeah, it's something we take for granted.
It really is a part of their everyday life. I have an aunt who still lives just outside of Paris, and, you know, anytime we get to go visit, you meet people, and there's a cheese course to literally every dinner meal includes a cheese course, and no matter where you are in the country. You know, just recently I was down in the Loire Valley, and what they do in the Loire Valley is, even in the simplest of restaurants, they bring you a couple of local cheeses, be it a Samoor or Valençay, depends on where in the countryside you are. But you can just get even the simplest cheeses in the simplest restaurant have become part of their culture.
Okay, French boy and Francophile, let's talk about American cheese for a moment. John, what's going on in the world of American cheese from your perspective?
You're talking about yellow or white?
Yeah, we have the land of lakes.
So. Real American cheese. I mean, I find that to be exciting. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Well, I think, right now, I think the most exciting cheese boards, the most exciting cheese are still in restaurants. But as it's getting more and more popular as a course for people, and I think that different places in New York and outside in California and places across the country are really bringing cheese to the table, so to speak.
Well, I'm talking about producers, John. What about?
Oh, producers. You have your small artisanal producers. What they do is they take French and other Italian ideas and French ideas, and they make cheese kind of in the way that they make them back in France, except they do it. They do it almost in their own style to have their own signature. And there's beautiful artisanal farmers all over the country that make great cheeses that we're lucky enough to actually get here at the restaurant as well.
Is this a more recent phenomenon as far as the American production of cheese? I mean, what's happened in the years that you've been doing this?
Well, I think there's definitely more of a call for artisanal cheeses, because the whole process, turn and burn cheese, that you can get in a supermarket, that's okay.
Yeah, nobody wants burnt cheese.
There's really no place for that in a fine dining restaurant, I don't think. So I think there's a demand from these farmers to produce these beautiful small little cheeses that have limited production that just find their way in cheese boards.
What do you think makes a good cheese board, John?
I think a great cheese board has variety. You know, you should always have different milks from different animals, of course, sheep, goat, and cow. You should also have some blues. And just different consistencies. You should have hard cheeses. You should have wet cheeses. You should have beautiful dry cheeses. And you should also have really nice, fatty style cheeses, because it's a variety. Because not all cheese is the same. And you definitely need to understand on your palate to try different cheeses.
Honestly, one of the things that I think we do better in this country is that whole... You can actually get a cheese board of a lot of different kinds of cheeses. Places like Gramercy Tavern in Manhattan, or Stage Left, of course, in New Brunswick, where we offer a real spectrum, a real array of different kinds of cheeses. Where still, I think, even some parts of the world, there's not the selection, there's not the different types of cheeses. Sometimes you're pigeonholed into the cheeses of that region.
Well, and also when you talk about having cheese on a cheese board after dinner, whether it's in your house or in a restaurant, and I think one of the reasons that cheeses work in a restaurant is that, you know, people say, well, why will I pay that kind of money for a piece of cheese? You know, it's like I understand that I pay more for the chicken because they cook the chicken. But I think that John's role in a great cheese course really comes in aging the cheese. Talk to us about aging cheese and when it is appropriate time to have cheese and what temperature is to have cheese and how hard and frankly expensive that is, because I'm the
right
one paying for it while you're the one doing it.
It's a terribly expensive endeavor. I mean, when you get a cheese off of, you know, off the boat or from the importer, it's not ready yet, and almost like a certain wine that needs to age. What you do is you lay it down, you try and get a temperature and humidity controlled room. And what you want to do is you want to age it in a way where you know what you know what the end is going to produce.
Well, what is the end you're looking for? I guess that's the idea. What are you
looking for something that is almost perfectly ripe. Because to serve the cheeses that we serve on our cheese board, and frankly,
sorry, you said ripe like a piece of fruit? Is that?
And what happens over time is that a cheese will come in and it'll ripen. And it'll almost turn into a more mature style of cheese. and it'll be almost completely different from the way we get it. It'll become softer if that's supposed to way if that's the way it's supposed to happen. It'll
and,
get
and it takes just so everybody knows, it takes a little expertise to know when cheese is ripe, because cheese can go too far or it can be too young.
Absolutely, and then one of the best and worst parts of the job is tasting it every day, because if you taste it when it's too young or if it's too old, it's going to be downright terrible. But if you get it at that perfect, that peak moment.
John, we're going to bring you back right after the break. We're going to take a small break. Central Jersey, 1450 time is 11:25.
Welcome back to the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. We're here, we're Mark Pascal and Francis Schott, and we're here talking to John Kafarski, the fromager from Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick. John was just talking a little bit about ripening cheeses and how you know when a cheese has gotten to that perfect point.
Yeah, what...
John, why don't you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and what I do is, like I said before, is that we get multiple wheels, or let's say we get multiple wheels or multiple pieces of cheese, and then we age. And you have to taste as it goes along. And if it's not ripe enough, it's just not ready. The flavors really haven't come out yet. And if it's gone too far, it almost sours. It almost turns into something that's just not a pleasurable thing to eat.
Yeah, I've definitely had those cheeses that taste like ammonia.
Right, in ammonia, and you get like that Windexy ammonia thing going on, and it's just a terrible taste, and you can't do anything about it.
Well, and because cheese flavors are so strong, I mean, it takes a lot of experience to know exactly when a cheese is ripe. Because when John says you try them all along, you don't actually taste them. You feel the cheese, you look at the cheese, you touch the cheese for softness and ripeness, and you need to know when it's ripe because there's such strong flavors.
And when you go to restaurants such as Stage Left or a beautiful three Michelin restaurant in France. What you're getting on the board is when that cheese is perfect.
Yep.
I mean, it's time to have it right then, right now, and that's when you know that cheese is beautiful and just delicious. And
and it also means that a lot of cheese got either thrown away
absolutely.
Or cared for. If you miss, you miss, and that doesn't make the patron's table, and that's the important thing.
John is, and something that's kind of come about very recently is John has become an affineur. He's become a person who is aging and deciding when a cheese is ready to be served, as opposed to just a cheese buyer who's buying cheese and serving it.
Yeah, that's pretty complicated stuff. Well, John, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I know you want to go and poke and prod your cheeses down in the Cove at Stage Left.
We'll prod one for me, John.
Of course.
Yeah, exactly. Make sure there's something nice when we get into work today.
And also open up a nice bottle of wine from your guys' selection, and I'll enjoy my time down
just
here in the
basement. Leave the money on my desk.
Of course.
So that's the beginning of our show. We're done talking about cheese for now, and we're going to come back in the next segment and talk to Peter Schleimer, an Austrian restaurant critic and wine writer, who's going to talk to us about Austrian wine, some sweet wine, some dry wine, and some wines that go with cheese.
A little bit of the Austrian countryside.
Well, and the city. And
yes.
He's sort of Peter is actually a pretty well respected authority who has sort of taken me restaurant reviewing with him in Austria and throughout Austria on motorcycles and been a general bon vivant. And so we are the restaurant guys. Central Jersey 1450 time is 11:30.
Hi, and welcome back to 1450 AM. You're here with the restaurant guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. We are about to speak with Austrian wine writer and wine critic, food critic extraordinaire, Peter Schleimer, general bon vivant. Hello, Peter. How are you today?
I'm very fine. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Peter. This is Francis.
I am very happy to be with you.
Well, I'm very happy to have you all the way from Austria, and thanks for working with us on the time delay and all. But we had our first segment today. We talked about cheese, and today we want to finish up talking about sweet wine in particular, but also about Austrian wine and all things Austrian. And you review restaurants in Austria still, is that correct?
I do, yes.
Yeah, and you bring a lot of wines from Austria into the United States. You work with a couple of importers. Are there a lot of is there a lot of interest in Austrian wines in the United States over the last several years? You found
it has been actually fascinating to see how quickly this the interest and the acceptance has grown, and there's been a lot of excitement over. We've experienced a lot of excitement over with wine lovers who'd like to try new wines.
Yeah, well, what kind of wines do you find are mostly coming over to the United States? Are you moving a lot of sweet wine over in the United States?
There's a certain amount of sweet wine coming over, which is one of Austria's, let's say, greatest types of wines. But I think the major thing for Austria is the grape variety, the special grape variety we have, which is Grüne Veltliner, and that is quite hot in some cities in the States.
Peter, you can't fool me. I've been to Austria. You're covered with snow and ice. There's no vines. There's just skiing. Is that all you have over there? Tell the truth.
Well, you're right about snow right now, but it's just covering the wines, keeping them kind of protected from the really bad cold. No, we have around 40,000 hectares under vines in Austria, astonishingly, which not many people would know, but and a very specific type of wine, mainly white wines.
A hectare is about 2.2 acres, isn't that right, Peter?
That is correct, yeah.
Well, now, your wines came to the United States only a couple of years ago that you really started, the Austrians broke into the American market. I'd say that's about 96. Where are you finding wine is accepted in the United States, and what kind of wines do you find people are buying and drinking, and where is it? Is it in the major cities? Is it in the South? What's going on?
Well, we have mainly kind of conquered the coasts, actually. I mean, California and New York are definitely the two hot spots, with New Jersey also a very important market. And then there's quite a bit going on in Illinois and several other states, but more to the north. The South is still a part of the U.S. We have to kind of show the wines and talk more about, because they know very little about our wines yet.
Peter, I know why New Jersey's become an important state, because Francis has about 40 Grüner Veltliner on the stage left wine list.
We have to support our friend Peter in the country of Austria. So, but tell us, Peter, because a lot of our listeners are not familiar with Austrian wine, and I'm hoping they all come into our restaurant and buy many, many cases of Austrian wine. With the Grüner Veltliner, what do you find about it as far as food properties, and how is it utilized mostly in Austria, and how do you think people are using it mostly in the United States?
Well, Grüner Veltliner is a really exciting grape variety, because it's, I think everybody who is knowledgeable about wine and who tastes Grüner Veltliner has the chance to taste it and taste the best examples agrees that it is easily one of the classical grape varieties of the world. It can age wonderfully in the best examples for many decades, and ages slower than, for example, Riesling, which is also an important grape variety. But the fascinating thing is that it's very versatile. First of all, you can either make a light and fruity and bouncy piquant wine from Grüner Veltliner, or you can make a very full-bodied, creamy, rich wine.
And dry, you can go dry or sweet with Grüner Veltliner, is that correct?
You can go dry or sweet, but in Austria we prefer the rather dry styles,
yeah.
So low sugar levels, yeah. And then the other fascinating thing is that Grüner Veltliner is extremely sensational for a lot of kinds of food. So you can have it with especially Asian cuisine, and then all sorts, you know, the classical stuff like pork chops, white meat. But in, you know, when it's very creamy and very rich, you could even take it and use it with beef or something.
Well, you know, it's funny. We have one of the problems I find in matching food and wine around here that Grüner Veltliner solves for me here in the United States is I find many vegetables are very difficult to match with wines, because broccoli can make Chardonnay taste off, and asparagus, if it's not done with the right wine, can be awful, and the notoriously difficult artichoke. But you sort of Grüner Veltliner for us at the restaurant is kind of like the magic pill. Is that sort of its reputation?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think the thing is maybe that Grüner Veltliner has a certain spiciness. An Austrian would always, you know, an Austrian translating the word would always say it's peppery. Peppery not necessarily meaning black pepper. It's kind of a mixture of, you know, peppery in a pepper style, black pepper style, and peppery in a bell pepper style. So there certainly are related aromas there. And if you have the lighter examples of Grüner Veltliner, you certainly have some green vegetable, fresh green vegetable aromas in there. And if you have the very ripe examples, you often have sweet yellow kind of vegetable aromas in there, and that's also...
I'm sure you mean that in a good way, right, Peter?
Oh, in a perfectly good way. It's really neat. I mean, if you if you can imagine like squash or sweet pumpkin, you know, that really, it's savory. It's wonderful.
Can you tell us, Peter, you know, Austrian wine is new to a lot of our guests and new to a lot of Americans. How important, I know the answer to this question because I've been in Austria with you and I've walked through St. Stephen's Platz in the snowstorm at night, but what is the role of wine in Austria? I mean, in Vienna, when I go to the wine shops, I see, you know, the Grand Cru Burgundy right next to the great Austrian wines, and they're the same price, and there's more interest in the Austrian wines than there are in the Burgundy. I mean, what role is wine in culture? Because we think of Austria as a beer culture.
Oh, yeah, that is an absolute misconception. No, Austria is a total wine-freaky country. So
it's actually a great drinking country.
Austrians
I've met.
And actually, you're a bit of a wine freak. You're a little, well, you know, yourself there, Peter.
But that is not totally untrue.
But do you think people, is there more wine consumed in Austria or beer, do you think?
Well, in liters, it would probably be beer, but it is definitely a wine. It's a wine culture. And then there's also, you know, there's a difference between Eastern Austria and Western. Eastern part is where the vines grow. So in Eastern Austria, I'm sure you have much stronger wine consumption and wine culture than in the Western parts, even though the Western parts, are, you know, in the good hotels and everywhere, you can get the fantastic Austrian wines. But it's a, you know, in Vienna, for example, you just walk around, and in every place you can get a few different wines by the glass, you know, cheap cafes and stuff like that. It's a very important part. And then we have these Heurigen, which are the kind of wine bars installed by producers themselves where they sell their own wines and some rustic food. And it's just great. It's a very great culture, and all people partake in it.
I've had the great good fortune to actually hang out with Peter and drink wine in some of these places in Austria, and it is pretty amazing. There's quite a nightlife that goes on there. I remember the beginnings of almost all of the evenings, but I'm a little unclear on the endings. So.
Well, true enough.
Peter is our friend. Peter is a little subdued today, but I'm sure we'll get a little bit more to this true character in our next segment. We're going to be talking about some sweet wines and how they work with some of the cheeses that we were talking about with John Kafarski earlier today, and we're going to talk a little bit about some Austrian foods and some really interesting things that are brought in from Austria. As well as some of those secret ingredients that we use in the restaurant to make some dishes really pop in their final moments. So here we are. It's 11:45 on WCTC, and we are the Restaurant Guys. Hi, we're back with the Restaurant Guys on WCTC 1450 AM. We're here talking to Peter Schleimer, Austrian wine writer and columnist, live with us from Austria. Peter, nice to talk to you again.
Good to be here still.
You know, Peter, we had talked a little bit about sweet wine before, but I was hoping that you could tell our listening audience about the very special wine called Ausbruch.
I'll tell you, Peter, one of the finest and seminal moments in my Austrian wine world was a wine by the name of Ausbruch by a producer called Heidi Schrock that I had back in probably 1993. Just absolutely blew me away.
What is the story in this Ausbruch, Peter? We want to know.
Oh, yes, I'll tell you. Heidi Schrock, by the way, is one of the important people in a town called Hust, a small town on the shore of Lake Neusiedl, and she's a wonderful gal. You know her, Francis?
Yes.
And she makes this specific wine called Ausbruch. Ausbruch actually is...
Sounds different when you say it, Peter.
I know it does. It's like breaking out, like a prisoner escaping, but that's not the meaning. It's actually means that you have these berries which you on your vines that get very, very ripe. You harvest extremely late, and you have this substance called botrytis that infects the grapes. It's actually a fungus and causes small holes.
Peter, none of this sounds very attractive. Why does it make wine good?
The great thing about this grape is it makes it has these small holes. The grapes get these small holes, so the water evaporates, and it gets extremely concentrated. And the botrytis actually gives the wine a wonderful taste. It's honey bready kind of style, like freshly baked bread. It's wonderful.
And it's always sweet. That's right, Peter?
It's always sweet. This is always sweet because you could never make it dry. They are so concentrated. The sugar levels are so high that the wine would never ferment to dryness.
Well, and what people may not realize is it's one of the most long aging wines. And what do you have with this wine? What do you eat with this wine?
Well, this wine is perfect for a variety of different foods, but mainly I'd say one of the absolute classics is blue cheese. Blue cheese of every sort and kind. It can be an exciting experience to combine those two groups.
I'm all a titter.
Pardon?
I'm all a titter.
Well, I've actually done this. We've had some wild tastings in my time as wine writer and wine critic. I also did a project of wine and cheese matchings, and that was extremely pleasurable, but extremely strenuous too, because we had something like 100 different pairings. And
Peter, I've hung out with you, and I realize that most of your life is extremely pleasurable and extremely wonderful, and that's why I visit you as often as I do. And I want to share with you one small story that I have with Peter Schleimer. We were walking through St. Stephen's Platz, and if you've never visited Austria, you can actually contact us at restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll give you some suggestions as places to visit. But we were walking through St. Stephen's Platz, Peter and I, in the middle of the night, and we maybe had a couple of glasses of Grüner Veltliner, I think. Don't you think so?
Maybe, yeah.
And Peter said, he said, Francis, do you know that Vienna is the safest large city in all of Europe? And I said, well, no, Peter, I didn't know that. And he said, yes, and it's one of the cleanest. And I said, well, to what do you attribute that? And Peter looked at me rather quizzically, and he said, to the Austrians is what I attribute that to. And so it's a lovely place to visit.
For those of you who don't know, Peter Schleimer is with us. He's an Austrian food writer and
restaurant critic,
and man about town. Seems that every night that we've ever spent with Peter Schleimer ends in the morning as opposed to in the evening.
Oh, yes. I remember about a month ago.
Well, so, Peter, can you give us, we have to close soon, but can you give us some good recent vintages in Austria, maybe give us a couple of recent vintages to look for, and give us a couple of your favorite producers?
Okay. I think if you're looking for a dry, bouncy, light wine, you'll be very, very happy with the 2004 vintage, which will be coming in the fall this year, or a 2002 and 2001. They are a little lighter and a little higher in acidity. If you're looking for a fuller-bodied wine, I'd go for a 2003 or a 2000. That would cover the recent vintages.
Okay, and I'm asking you to pick among your children, but give me three top producers that you love.
I would say sensational, really up in the top ranks since 3 years, Schloss Gobelsberg,
yeah,
in Comptau. Then if I would take a red wine producer, I would say Ernst Triebaumer in Rust.
Uh-huh.
And for a sweet wine producer, I would take up your suggestion and say Heidi Schreck in Rust.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you, for those of you who cannot spell from Peter's pronunciation, we'll put those up on our website later. That's restaurantguysradio.com.
Okay, we'll be back in just a little bit. It's with Peter Schleimer. We're going to have some closing comments.
Peter's got to go, Mark.
Okay, Peter. Well, we're going to talk after you leave. We're going to talk a little bit about pumpkin seed oil.
And about you.
And about you, of course.
Oh, no. Please don't.
Central Jersey talk time is 11:55. Welcome back to the Restaurant Guys on Central Jersey, 1450 AM. We have just finished talking with Peter Schleimer, Austrian restaurant critic and wine writer and wine importer and general bon vivant about amazing Austrian wines. You know, we got to tell my little story about walking through St. Stephen's Platz with Peter in the middle of the night. Don't you have a little Austrian story, Mark, about the Schwimmhalle when you were a kid?
Oh, you pain me.
I do.
My first trip to Austria, I must have been about 12 years old. And my father really liked to go where the natives go. He hates to do the touristy things, though we do those very quickly. And then we go try and do what the people of the Austrians were doing. So he found this great little Schwimmhalle, which is a swim house, sauna place. And off we went he scoped it out, got us all ready, took us to the Schwimmhalle. Well, we get to the Schwimmhalle
And, you know, the women go one way, the men go the other way. And, you know, in the Austrian Schwimmhalle, unlike a lot of places here, you get completely naked.
Yeah, those Europeans love to get naked, don't
they? Yeah, they're really big fans of that. So I'm a 12-year-old boy, kind of at that point of post-pubescence, just barely. And I get naked, as uncomfortable as that is, walk out of the locker room and into the sauna area. Well, I open the sauna door, and there is men and women of various ages, mostly older ages, sitting around completely naked in the sauna.
As a 12-year-old boy, that was rather traumatic.
It wasn't the greatest moment of my life.
I used to have fantasies like that.
Yeah, you didn't see the 60-year-old Austrian women
they
saw.
They weren't
totally
exactly
different fantasy, trust
exactly
me. So I'm standing at the door, mm-hmm. and the very last thing that happens to me is a large woman named Gertrude shoves me in, says I'm letting all the heat out, and slams the door behind me. Stuck into the shrimp hollow.
I like my story better. I really do. All right, so, well, thanks for joining us today. We hope you've enjoyed the show as much as we have. We've had some great advice. Some of that advice is from Mark Pascal, which is don't visit the shrimp hollow unless you know what you're expecting. But we also had
lots of ugly nakedness.
We also had a lovely conversation about cheese with John Kafarski, the maitre de fromage at Stage Left Restaurant. And a lovely time talking with Austrian restaurant critic and wine writer Peter Schleimer about Austrian wines and what's available in the country.
Next time we have Peter on, we have to talk about some of the motorcycle stories.
The motorcycle diaries. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you again. We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 12 noon.